Hey, Undisclosed listeners, we are back. We are back on a very exciting day because today there has been a new filing in Adnan's case. So Susan, Colin, and I have come back together to update you about it, give it the undisclosed treatment, and walk you through this motion that was filed by the state's attorney. And it is a motion to vacate judgment. All right, before we get into it, hey, Colin. Hey, Susan.
Hey, hey. Rabia. Good day today.
Good day, and good to hear from you guys, and good to be back on.
Yeah, well, this is not where I expected this case to be going four years ago, if you'd asked me. Like, if asked me, like, the possible variations of how things could play out, I don't think this was on the bingo card.
Oh, not for me. I never could have imagined this a million years, ever. I mean, unless, like, God, I don't know, maybe... The truth is, like, I never knew where Mosby stood on this case because she never really was on it, right? Like,
no, she was. Yeah. She's until fairly recently has not been a name that we talked about in terms of this case or that seemed to have an active role in it.
Yeah, the attorney general is who was handling the case through the appellate process, but according to this motion, Mosby's office has been investigating, or I suppose reinvestigating, this case for the last year.
Well, we knew that they actually had decided to agree to DNA testing. That was what, a few months ago, a lifetime ago?
Yeah. I mean, like, honestly, if you go by the amount of times people ask me about the DNA testing, it happened like 3,000 years ago. I get asked like 5 times a day, and I'm going to block the next person who asked. But I think it was like in March or April. But yeah, it was in the spring. It was a while ago.
So we knew from that the government was cooperating with the investigation. They were open to reinvestigating the case. You would like it to be that in every single case of a possible wrongful conviction that the government would want to do DNA testing. That's not how it usually works. Was not how it worked in this case until then. But it's not just DNA testing that they've been doing.
Yeah, they've been doing some other stuff. Colin, can you explain, what does this motion mean? What are they asking? If somebody says vacate judgment, what is the state's attorney's office asking a court to do here?
Yeah, when they move to vacate the judgment of conviction, they're essentially asking the judge to throw out Adnan's murder conviction, claiming they lack confidence in it and it lacks integrity. And they say at a minimum, he should be granted a new trial. But really, when you read the motion and you look at how they eviscerate the state's case and misconduct, they're really saying you should drop the conviction and we're not going to retry in the absence of something like DNA evidence coming back.
Oh, is that how you read it?
This is the prosecutor's office saying, we do not stand behind this conviction anymore. We no longer believe that it's valid. We don't believe that it is consistent with justice. And we're asking the courts to vacate it.
Procedurally, there would be a hearing now, and then the court would make a decision, grant or deny the motion. But if the court grants this motion, that's not an exoneration though, is it?
Depends how you define exoneration. I mean, exoneration, you have things like in Maryland, you can file a petition for writ of actual innocence, and you might say narrowly, that's the only way you can have an exoneration. This is probably the next best thing where the state says we don't stand behind our prior conviction. It's basically fatally flawed. And so I would define it as an exoneration. It'll go into the National Registry of Exonerations if
it
this goes through. Yeah.
And is that how you see this too, Susan?
Yeah, it's... Okay. I mean, the question of what is and is not exoneration is more philosophical than it is like practical. And for all purposes, yes, this would be an exoneration.
Okay.
Now the next step is for the judge to get on board as well.
All right. So let's get into like the body of the motion. Like what it's about 20, 21 pages long, and it starts out with a bang.
Well, the first up, they talk about the DNA results. And unfortunately, there was no Hail Mary pass there that came through. The DNA has not yet given any conclusive results.
Okay, well, that wasn't the bang I was talking about. I was just saying that they're like, we've done a year-long investigation, which was like, to me, like, great to see. But you're right. Yeah, the DNA was a little bit like, but are they saying that they've done, like, all the DNA testing they requested to be done has all been done? It seems like it, right?
Yeah, it's not entirely clear from the filing here. It does seem like all the stuff that was done back in March and April has been tested. I know there are some other samples that I'm very curious to one day maybe hopefully have analyzed. But yeah,
on page two, it does say the last sentence on page two, the remaining items are currently being reviewed for further testing.
Oh,
so
yeah.
There might still be additional testing that's possible here.
Yeah.
I mean, look, the DNA in this case, it would be amazing to get an answer there. But for a lot of reasons, most of them having to do with Baltimore and its evidence collection practices, I just never had as much hope as I wish I could have had for it.
I will say this. My understanding is that they did not use the MVAC technique, which is actually able to pick up smaller samples of DNA. And I wonder if the state will do that next, because, you know, I think they repeat this a couple of times in the motion that this is an ongoing investigation. Like, we are still trying to figure out, like, who did this. And so I wonder if the next step might be not just finishing off those, whatever the further testing they're talking about, but also the other items that they have tested but not done MVAC, send it for MVAC, which I think would make sense to me. I wish they would do that.
Yeah.
But my understanding is once you do MVAC, then kind of like, you can't do anything else with that evidence. But then if you don't do it, then what are you going to do? It's just going to sit around anyways. You may as well do it. So, okay, they go through the facts of the case and procedural history. And I think we can skip that because we have talked about that for hundreds of hours. Then they set up, like, what are the legal requirements of the state's motion to vacate? And Colin, you want to talk a little bit about that? You think what they've laid out here meets those requirements?
Yeah, absolutely. So if we look there, this is page 6 of the motion. It's that the state's attorney received new information that basically calls into question the integrity of the conviction, and the interest of justice and fairness justify vacating the conviction in the case. And essentially, this is the key word, right? Undisclosed. It's a Brady violation. Mm. Two alternate suspects here. They say they were insufficiently investigated, and they have some pretty juicy details about these alternate suspects. The one that stood out for me, and it's not to say the other one doesn't, is when they say, at the time of trial, the state had in its file, and they didn't disclose this to the defense, one of the suspects had a motive to kill Haman Lee, had threatened to kill the victim in the presence of another individual, specifically said he would make her, hey, disappear, he would kill her. And so we have this statement, but also they're saying that there was a motive to kill. So, like, we're not talking about someone being cut off in traffic or like a classmate being angry, a motive to kill. So we don't know who that is, but that to say they had a motive to kill, that means that's a pretty strong motive that must have existed. And then the statement, of course, is shocking.
And apparently
the fact that the state's had that the whole time and through multiple rounds of prosecutors, it has somehow mysteriously never come to the attention of defense.
Yeah. Who was the last prosecutor who was working on this case? What was his name? Yeah.
I'm just saying, I went through the file myself and it had been taken out before I got to it. So someone else has seen it.
Wow. And okay. So about this suspect you're talking about, you know, the one that who apparently threatened to kill Hay, there's also a second report was made to the prosecutor about the same person. That's what it says in the motion. So, like, two different sources reported to Kevin Urich at the time in 99 that this is a suspect who you might want to look at. And they not only did not look at it, but they also hid it from the defense. Big Brady violation. I mean, like, what? So on the basis of that alone, do you think that rises to the level of, like, that alone should grant a new trial?
Oh, absolutely. 100%. I mean, if the state has evidence of an alternate suspect with a motive to kill, and they said they would kill the victim, I mean, that's about as glaring and blatant of a Brady violation as you can get. Again, Brady, just as a refresher, is material exculpatory evidence, a reasonable probability it could have impacted the jury's verdict and led to a different verdict. And I think looking at this, absolutely, that falls into that category.
Mm. You know, our listeners have that undisclosed law degree. They know what Brady is. You know, I was told that when I, you know, when this was filed, I was like, you know, has State Attorney Mosby done something like this before? She actually had. She'd filed a motion to vacate in a different case last year, and it was granted. I learned it was a very small, it was like a 2-page motion. So this is a pretty robust motion, which is good. And I'm sure they're like, we got to make sure everything's in there that could possibly be in there because the case has so much publicity and stuff. But so they talk about the two suspects. Should we talk about, like, it's interesting that they say that these suspects could have worked together or they could be, like, individual.
We've been asked not to speculate on the identity of two suspects. Unfortunately, the identity is obviously crucial to the factual evidence here and to the basis of the state's motion.
But so, I mean, like, so one of the suspects we know, like, as Colin mentioned, is somebody who threatened Haman Lee. This was reported. But what are some of the other shady things these suspects have done?
Well, they describe in the motion how this suspect has been convicted of rape.
Right.
Systematic rape, in fact.
Right. You can't always tell which suspect did what, but they kind of go back and forth.
Yeah. And then specifically, Wright had attacked, I think, a female victim, or at least a victim in their car, which, of course, Hay was last seen in her car, if we believe the testimony of
right.
Inez Butler, which is questionable on its own.
Right. But I mean, at a minute, like, hey, unless she had been attacked at school, she had to have driven away from school in her car. I mean, that's what we think, right? So she would have been in her car. If this guy has a history of, or a record of, like, you know, attacking women in the car, one of these suspects, that's certainly alarming. The car, her car, can we talk about the location?
Yeah, I think this is crucial because to me, the two things we have that are relatively solid are where Hay was found and where the car was in the intervening weeks. And I think it would be a very specific type of perpetrator who would be familiar with both these locations.
Right.
Apparently one suspect was in fact familiar with at least the place where the car was found because he has a relative who lived there. Remember, her car was abandoned in a sort of, not an alley, like a courtyard area in the back, behind several row houses.
Right. It's like this big yard. It's kind of like this big collective parking lot. Yeah, shared backyard, which really was a parking lot, used as a parking lot. And it's surrounded by like townhomes, basically.
And this suspect had a relative that lived in one of those homes. So he would have been familiar with that spot and known it was a place a car could be left.
Mm. Colin, you're going to say?
Yeah, right. So, I mean, I think just the facts you laid out, they lay out three facts. One, the location was known to one of the suspects. Two, a person related to the family owned a home in that block of Edgewood Road, which is where the car was. And then three, that relative lived there in 1999.
Right.
So, you know, the state's theory is that Adnan sort of stumbles upon this location to leave the car. And now we have an alternate suspect who has a direct connection with that location. So you can kind of add up and see why this is important.
And I don't think I'm saying too much to note that the suspect also very reasonably has a connection to the burial site as well.
This is that, right, if we are thinking about the same suspect, yeah. You know, it's interesting, it says here, the state uncovered this information during an investigation in 2022. This information was not available to the defendant in his trial in 2000. But don't you think it could have been, maybe? It could have been?
If they'd done a thorough investigation, it would have been.
Okay. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I guess we don't know the basis of this, so we kind of can't make that judgment, I suppose. But one of the suspects was improperly cleared as a suspect. This is interesting. This is one of the other big, like, they've written up a couple pages about this. So they say that, you know, there was one suspect who was polygraphed twice. Again, we're not allowed to speculate. Y'all can speculate based on what you know about the case, what we've told you about the case, and that he was improperly cleared. And this is really interesting because they got an expert to take a look at that second polygraph, which we have always been like, what is this? And be like, this is not even proper. Can we go into details about this?
It's a little bit difficult to, let's see, let's put it this way. This suspect, I think there's a story there that we have not yet learned, and maybe the state's attorney has, that'd be amazing, mm-hmm. about how and why exactly the decision was made to clear the suspect, because it's never made any sense. I've never been able to follow the logic of Ritz McGillivray when they decided that the suspect could be or should be cleared. It's baffling. And as the motion lays out, that should never have happened. Absolutely not.
Yeah. So, you know, in the motion, they talk about like the suspect took the first polygraph and was found to be deceptive. The second polygraph that was administered to him was not like a regular polygraph. It's not the kind of polygraph that would have been used to disconfirm a deception result, but it was something called a peak of tension test, according to this expert. I've never heard of that before.
It's not the common, it's not what you, not that any polygraph is reasonable evidence, but like, it's not even what typical polygraph administrators do. And even stranger is that the kind of questions they were asking are, I've still never seen another case where a polygrapher asked questions in this manner of like, was the victim killed with a knife? Was the victim killed with like a candlestick?
Like, basically, yeah. I mean, it's right. It's, you can distinguish that there's, you call one a concealed information test where it's the suspect wouldn't be clear when you're getting to what's incriminatory. Whereas Peak of Tension is, it's sort of a narrative and it builds up in a cohesive narrative fashion. And so they're saying Peak of Tension is worse, which, as Susan just noted, we all know Polygraph generally is unreliable. Yeah, but Peak of Tension would be especially unreliable. And that's the point that this expert is making in this filing. Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I've always believed this, and I think all of us have, like, you know, it seemed like that second test was given deliberately to be able to set the suspect aside and move on.
Yeah. 1,000%. There's no other reason. I mean, Ritz McGillivray knew very well this was not the standard way of doing it. They had a goal in mind when they performed this test, or had this test performed.
And like you said, I mean, I hope we know that story one day as to why they so desperately wanted for it not to be the suspect. So that's kind of like, I guess, the bulk of, like, kind of the new evidence, I guess, that they're saying that, you know, that they've discovered in the last year. And then they go back to, like, the reliability of the evidence at trial. So they're trying to make the case that what was even presented that convicted Adnan was like, not sound.
Yeah.
And Susan, you got to take the incoming.
Well,
it's all you.
Finally, the state has done some actual reconsideration of the evidence in this case, particularly the cell evidence, and has acknowledged that it was bullshit. Technical term for it. It's just that the evidence isn't there. Like, if this was being redone now, if they were in a trial, like, no attorney that was ethical would proceed in the manner that either Gutierrez or the prosecution did. Because the evidence here is, by its own, like, facial declaration, not valid. It is not evidence that can be used in the way it was used at trial.
Yeah. Colin, do you want to add to that?
I think Susan nailed it here, right? This is something that we've been harping on, specifically Susan has been harping on since before Undisclosed, that we have this AT&T disclaimer, says incoming calls are not reliable. Judge Welch, the original judge on appeal here, basically said this is the crux of the state's case and it's the linchpin. And beyond the disclaimer, there are issues with using cell tower pings, but yeah, I mean, that's the central issue, is this could not and should not have been used in this trial.
Yeah.
I mean, and the state's own expert, Abel Horwitz,
who Susan found.
Yeah. He now, if he had known what was going on, this isn't the testimony that was given would never have come out that way.
Yeah. And by the way, who withheld that fax cover sheet with that information from Horwitz? Kevin Urich. I feel like there's a pattern here. I don't know. You know, so basically junk science. Can we say this was junk science?
It was junk science. It was junk prosecuting. It was just
junk investigation.
Yeah, well, it all goes back, of course, to the investigation. This data, which was not understood by the police, was used by them to get Jay to give a story. And not only was the data unreliable to begin with, the detectives misused it. They, like, wrote down wrong sectors at some points and use their incorrect transcripts of unreliable data to get Jay to keep changing a story to tell them what happened that day.
If you guys want to see this, like, being unraveled in real time, you got to watch the HBO series, if you haven't seen it yet, The Case Against Adnan Syed, with Susan and all her maps and explaining, like, how it's like one of my favorite scenes in the whole series. But yeah, like, they literally were like, they're like, we have a story. We got to try to make sure Adnan was here, here, and here. And to fit that, they literally had the wrong, or they had the wrong cell tower information. Then they had to have Jay come up with a story to fit that cell tower information. And then they're like, shoot, we got it wrong. So, and speaking of Jay, that's the next section in this.
You can see there, not her real name, Kathy, aka Christina Vinson.
That's the next section. Yep.
Who Amy Berg and her team spoke to and interviewed, and you can see her on the show as she is given her school records, which show that on the day that Jay says he and Anon went to her place and Anon was stoned, well, Christy, she was in class.
Yeah.
That didn't happen. The story that Jay came up with based on the bad cell phone records didn't happen.
And the thing is, like, you know, when you watch that scene, she is so clearly shocked by it herself. You know, she really, but, you know, she talks about how, like, you know, the police didn't come to interview her till March, and she was telling them, okay, about something that happened back in January. That's a long time, first of all. And, you know, she herself, when she was confronted with the evidence that she had to have been in class that night, was just looked like, oh my God, I don't even know. So, you know, in this motion, what the state is doing is just like, you know, kind of taking some key elements of the state's case, the state's own case, and dismantling it for us, basically. And of course, even though they called the junk science the crux, I mean, really, without the state's witness, they couldn't have gotten this conviction, I think. And the state's witness was Jay Wilds. And this motion does a fine job of saying that he's completely not credible. Colin, you want to walk us through this part?
Yeah, well, right. In this case, they actually go right to the interview that Urich did with The Intercept, right, where he admits Jay's testimony by itself would probably not be enough for a conviction. And so here the state's attorney lays out exactly why that's the case.
I love this all part so much.
I know. The paragraph, it's a little bit petty, but I'm here for it.
Yeah, all the inconsistencies, all the changes to his story, the final change he makes in The Intercept story, they basically lay out why his story is internally inconsistent. It doesn't line up with the external evidence that we have in the case, including if we did use the cell tower pings. And it just lays out, right? If you were relying upon Jay to get this conviction, that's not going to be enough for a conviction. Yeah. He is not a reliable or credible witness at all.
And the shade is strong when it comes to the interview and interrogation of Jay and the conduct of the investigators. I just want to read this paragraph because I was like, oh, I just relished it. It said, it was during this second interview that Wilds allegedly told police about the location of the victim's car. The detective stated on the recording that Wilds gave them the information of where the car was located before they returned the recorder back on when they were flipping the tape over. Wilds otherwise did not request that the recorder be turned off, and he was not refusing to talk. I just feel like I can just see eyes rolling as like this is being typed. You know what I mean?
The word allegedly there.
Yeah.
That is.
It's doing a lot of work. Yeah.
Yeah.
Allegedly. Yeah. I mean, and again, like this is just like, you know, Susan was like, Jay knew everything because the police told him. People are like, how did Jay know about the car? Because the police told him. I'm positive of it. Now, then it goes on to say the police interviewed Wilds again to, quote, clear up discrepancy. There's just so much shade. I love it. So whoever wrote this, thank you. And then it goes on to say, like, you know, something as simple as, like, you know, for example, the state's theory is a victim was killed after school and that the defendant called Wilds to pick him up at 2:36 p.m. Hello, call records. But that Jay repeatedly testified in two different trials that the defendant didn't call him until after 3:45, which would have totally thrown away like their timeline. You know, they talk about all the different places Jay said he found the body. Let's talk about this.
Where did Jay not see the body?
Yeah, I don't think they even include everything, right? They have Edmondson Avenue. They have the Best Buy, Grandma's house.
Kathy's house. I don't remember that
The pool
one.
Hall.
That was from the Intercept. Oh yeah, the pool hall.
Yeah, so they don't even include everything, but they certainly include enough of a flavor here where you can see, oh wow, okay, this is really a musical chairs here in terms of the story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Trunk popping all over town.
One thing I don't think I saw in this, and look, I only have read it once quickly. It's been a crazy day. I haven't gotten time to really look at it carefully, but is like, if you watch the documentary, right, at the end of the very end, I think, of the last episode, isn't there some text that comes on screen and says that Jay told the producer or the director of the documentary that the police told him about Best Buy and he didn't know it himself? That's in the documentary.
Was it included? Yeah, but that did happen. Yeah.
It was. Yeah, it was. It was just like text on screen. It was like the very end. Yeah. And I wish that was in here too, but all right. So, oh, and God, this brought me so much comfort to see the section about Detective Ritz. I don't think this has ever been brought up in court before. Has it? It hasn't.
The Malcolm Bryan case? I don't think so.
No, well, Detective Ritz passed misconduct.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it says but misconduct.
Rabia, everyone in this case was trying their best.
Yeah, just good guys doing their jobs. Okay, so Colin, you want to talk us through this?
Yeah, so there's a section, this is on page 18 of the motion, where they talk about the lead detectives in the case were Ritz and McGillivray, and they say, like, we're not able to say anything about this specific case, but there's a history here. They point to the Malcolm Bryant case that was a wrongful conviction. I think we talked about it in the Charm City episode of Undisclosed. It's been in my blog. And it's basically something where they failed to disclose evidence, just as the state failed to disclose evidence in Adnan's case. I think actually the Sabian Burgess case might even be more pertinent. They didn't cite that. They said Malcolm Bryant. Sabian Burgess is a case where there was a murder and an alternate suspect came forward and confessed. And they sort of deep sixed that and said, we don't believe you confessing. And then later it was found, yes, he was guilty. So yeah, they cite Malcolm Bryant. They very easily could have cited Sabian Burgess, which I think are both pertinent to this appeal. Yeah,
or Ezra's case where Ritz repeatedly pressured people to give false statements.
Right. I mean, Ritz, you know, he's got a history of this basically. And that's what they're saying, that there is a history of misconduct. I mean, I just feel so validated seeing that. And it talks about like the different cases that have been overturned because of these interrogation techniques that Ritz used. So in conclusion, it says that this is a case in which there is an abundance of issues that gives the state overwhelming cause for concern. The Brady violations robbed the defendant of information that would have bolstered his investigation. That the impact of the Brady violations was amplified by ineffective assistance of counsel, which I'm glad they also didn't overlook. I mean, I feel like in 20 pages, they really packed in like every angle, right? Was there anything that you were surprised that did not show up in here?
No, because I'm too surprised at how much they did include. So, I mean, it's still concise, given this case and like how...
There's a lot there.
There's a lot. So yeah. It's still concise, but it's a best highlights of here, judge, here is why we lost confidence in this case, and here's why it should be vacated.
Yeah, the only thing I might have expected to see, but I understand why not, is, you know, Susan's finding about the wrestling match, and so Inez Butler had the wrong day and all that. But that doesn't really point towards innocence necessarily. It's just a different narrative. So yeah, I think they included all the key facts you would have wanted in this.
I was a little surprised not to see anything but the lividity about the that stuff. To me, you know, whenever anybody said, what's the strongest evidence for Adnan's innocence? I'm like, I think it's the lividity, but people can disagree. So yeah, I was a little surprised that that wasn't there, but it's okay. It's okay. That information is out there. So then now let's get to that question that was posed to me today on the Instagram Live, and which is there any reason the judge could deny this?
I mean, yes, judges can be judges. If this was any other case, if this was not a Nans case and this motion came forward, I'd be like, yeah, that defendant's going home and pretty soon. And that could absolutely happen here, but I have learned, we've all learned the hard way not to assume that the normal will occur in this case.
Do you see anything glaring in the motion itself, Colin, that a judge might point to and say, no, wait a minute, like this is not sufficient. This doesn't rise to whatever the standard is, or I don't think your analysis is good here. Like anything in here. I'm forget that, like the political stuff and the publicity stuff, because I know, Susan, that's what you're talking about. What about in the motion itself?
I don't think so, because I mean, this is what I always teach my students, which is for a Brady violation, you're looking at two things. You're looking at sort of in a vacuum, how important is the undisclosed evidence? And then second, big picture, what was the evidentiary record against the defendant such that this undisclosed evidence could have made a difference? And to what we just discussed, right, they cover all the bases here. They undermine the state's case in so many ways to show it's a fundamentally weak and flawed case, meaning we can look at this undisclosed alternate suspect evidence and say this clearly was a Brady violation meeting the standard in Maryland. And as I said earlier, to say someone else had a motive to kill and said they would kill Haman Lee, that's a rock solid Brady piece of evidence there. And given the weakness of the rest of the case, it would be tough to see a judge say this doesn't meet the standard.
I think it's interesting that they chose to include two separate suspects to highlight that in their filing. I don't know if this is saying too much. I'll say it anyway. I don't think it's likely that there's a scenario where these two suspects work together. But I do think it was important for the state to highlight both of them, because for one of the suspects, there is just a huge, glaring, atrocious Brady violation, as Colin was saying. But just because there's a Brady violation doesn't necessarily mean factual guilt of another suspect.
Right.
And I think that they didn't want to have this other suspect overlooked.
Right. No, I think this was, I mean, it was the right way to frame this. And I think it also, I mean, the signal they're giving us, and they're saying it, they're like, we're not done investigating. We're still looking at this. And we're not, you know, we're not saying it on, say this innocent, but we don't believe in this conviction. But we are, I mean...
What they're saying is that there's a very big hole they've identified that they need to very much do a real investigation for finally, many years later.
Do you guys think there'll be an arrest in this case of somebody else?
Without DNA, it's hard, but I think it's possible. I don't rule it out. Without DNA, it's definitely, it's just such an old, at this point, trying to get beyond reasonable
doubt. Get a conviction, yeah.
Yeah. I want the circumstances of the motive to kill and the circumstances and timing of the statement, right? That's sort of, for me, is the big question. If it's a strong motive to kill and that statement is made relatively close in time to Hay
passing, but also
away,
depends on who's reporting this, right? Like,
true. It could be an unreliable witness. Sure. We want to check on that. So yeah, sort of the source of the information and then the content of that information.
Right. But Adnan had the right to like have that investigated at the time. And, you know, like, and that's the problem here. That's, you know, whoever this person is and whether or not he had any involvement. The bigger issue is that, why does Yurik have a law license still? I mean, how does this work? How can I get that taken away? Does anybody know? Okay. Is there anything else you guys want to like add to this?
No, I mean, in terms of timeline, I don't think we have a solid answer, but I think all indications are it will be relatively fast as far as the legal world goes.
My guess is like 2 days to 2 weeks.
Okay, well, that's lightning fast. So that's basically tomorrow. In terms of investigation, we don't know exactly where it stands right now or what they plan to do, but I do think there are some important avenues that they may have already looked into or maybe looking into now. And I think that's what the motion hints at, like, we haven't finished investigation here, but this is important. We want to do it. And the state has powers that the defense never will or never can. And they can actually get answers to stuff that we needed so long ago.
Yeah. Can we just like send them a list of questions? So they might not have all the questions. I will say this, though, also that, you know, what is being disclosed in this probably is just a fraction of what they have and know, right?
I suspect that they're, if this is what they're putting publicly for an ongoing investigation, I think it is, you can be confident that there is more about these suspects that has caught the attention of the prosecutor's office and I believe would eventually be revealed.
I am really heartened to know that there is an active investigation because, I mean, everybody who is Team Adnan wants, obviously, we want justice for Hay too. And so my hope is that they are able to get real evidence that can prove who killed her. I also want to say that, look, this... It would be remiss to talk about this without mentioning the work that Erica Souter has put in. Erica has been representing Adnan for the last 2.5 years. A year ago or so, she was hired to be the executive director of the Innocence Clinic at the University of Baltimore. And she has been just painstakingly taking this case apart from the ground up, like reinvestigating everything. And also, State Attorney Mosby has done a remarkable job, like exonerating, I think, like 13 people in the last couple of years.
Baltimore's approach to this has radically changed even since Undisclosed first aired. Like it's been a cultural shift at a lot of different levels too.
100%.
A political and a cultural change, like Baltimore especially, but even someone in Maryland.
Yeah, I agree. Was Marilyn Mosby state's attorney when we started? She wasn't she? I don't remember. But the case kind of just came to her like a year ago, you know, whenever they started investigating this. So it wasn't like we had any idea where she stood on any of it anyways. But her record shows that this is not like a one-off thing for Adnan's case. Like she has, for the last few years, really, I mean, she established the Conviction Integrity Review Unit and Sentencing Integrity Review Units in her department, which she's only one of two prosecutors in the whole state that's done something like that. So clearly, you know, like she has an interest in in trying to right wrongs. And I do appreciate that.
And Malcolm Bryant was one of the first cases, I believe, that she was strongly involved in. And that, that case is like what Ritz did there was, I mean, it was awful. And if you don't know, after he was exonerated, he died just a few months later.
Yeah.
So he was free for a very short amount of time.
I mean, it's life shattering what these people do to these innocent defendants. Well, I spoke to Adnan's mom today and his brother Yusuf on FaceTime, and Auntie was weeping. Of course, I've been weeping on and off, but it's kind of like, and we've all witnessed this, like we get so close and then like the rug gets pulled out. So yeah, we're incredibly hopeful. This is, nobody expected this, but also there's a judge now and we have no idea what the judge is going to do. And so I am still, you know, a little bit like, you know, I'm just going to like not celebrate quite yet. But I'd also, before we sign off, I want to talk about, Susan, you wrapped up first season of your new show Proof.
Yeah. Back in Rome, Georgia, which I'll actually be there this weekend again. And just a couple weeks away from the oral arguments for Joey Watkins' case.
Oh my God.
Supreme Court of Georgia.
Okay. Okay. Wait, what, can you tell us what's the oral arguments and what's happening? Is it a habeas?
Yeah. Joey's case has been strung out through the courts, through different procedural hurdles and back and forth. And he's now going to Supreme Court of Georgia for the second time. Well, probably like fourth time overall, but second time since the filings were made after season two undisclosed. And his conviction was overturned in February, March, April, sometime in that spring haze. Mm-hmm. And the state has appealed, and now Supreme Court will hear hear their arguments. Joy's case is very strong. I'm very optimistic. And
that's amazing.
We should get a result, hopefully favorable one, very shortly after.
When are oral arguments?
October 4th. I don't know what day of the week it is, but just a few weeks away.
So
now look to me from the Georgia Innocence Project Twitter feed that it'll be live streamed.
Yes.
Yeah, awesome. So
we'll send a link out on Twitter.
Yeah.
We also, there are hearings coming up in two other of our cases, Jason Carroll, which was kind of like the final season. He has a motion was filed, and there's a hearing in October. A motion was filed to get him released for the remainder of his sentence. So I don't know if that hearing will be live streamed, but certainly, and I don't have a date for it, but you know, we will share that. And in the Greg Lance case, there's been a petition filed for DNA testing. There has been a lot of opposition to that, though. The DA in that case has filed a 70-page motion or reply brief to oppose it. So, but there is a judge. It took forever. A judge finally got assigned to it, and I think they have a hearing coming up in October as well. So hopefully we'll see a lot of our defendants come home this fall. And that's what I'm hoping. Or early next
year. Early
2023. Susan, is there another season of Proof coming up?
Yes, there will be early next year as well. We'll be leaving Georgia. But there are unfortunately
spring,
no shortage.
Summer, fall. Yeah, exactly.
Springish, I think.
Okay, awesome. If you guys have not subscribed, definitely subscribe to Proof.
You can go to proofcrimepod.com and you can listen to season one there. And we'll be back shortly, hopefully, with unfortunately more cases that need to be brought to light.
And stay subscribed to this feed because Colin and I will be back on this feed with our new show with some innocence cases. Early next year. We don't know exactly when, but early next year. And so, and hopefully we'll keep jumping in like this whenever there's stuff that we need to come back together as a team to talk about. And I guess that's it. Colin, anything you want to add before we wrap up?
No. It's Pam Lanier, the North Carolina wrongful conviction, is supposed to have her habeas hearing this summer. It got delayed. And so if you follow my Twitter feed, I'll let you know when that hearing is rescheduled.
Awesome. Awesome. For folks who are like, are you guys still doing this work? We are still doing this work. I don't know if I'll ever like never be. And I feel like you guys are probably in that same space. Also, wait, one last thing. Susan had a baby.
I know that. We went over that.
Did we at the end of it, like undisclosed, did we? Okay.
She was like a month old then. I was barely alive.
Oh my God. She is the cutest thing. I follow her on Insta. I follow you posting about her on Insta. She's just like her mama. Adorable. Love her. All right. Okay, guys. Thank you for checking in. Keep your fingers crossed and prayers
fingers
up.
Fingers crossed. And yep. I will say, like, I don't want to get my hopes up, but despite myself, they're up this time.
Oh no, I'm not letting myself do it. I just won't. You know, I'll celebrate when the time comes. I'm just head down and keep moving forward one day at a time.
We'll celebrate then.
Yeah. All right, guys. Thank you so much. See you soon. Bye. Thank you to our executive producer, Mital Thelhan, to our audio editor, Hannah McCarthy, to Baluki for our logo, to Patrick Cortez for our theme song. As always, thank you to our sponsors for helping make these productions possible. And of course, thanks to our listeners. Don't forget to follow us on social media. Our Twitter handle is @UndisclosedPod, and we're also on Facebook and Instagram.